Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 145, entitled How to Understand Evolution, Science, and Our Genes, and What Our Future Holds as Human Beings, I chat with Perry Marshall. Perry Marshall is a best-selling author, one of the most sought-after business consultants in the world, and the creator of the Evolution 2.0 Prize. And he joins us today for a second time to tackle the infinitely intriguing and equally perplexing topic of evolution and how we as human beings came to be. He shares with us the secrets behind what evolutionists and creationists have learned over the last few decades and why they've both been wrong about how the universe and human beings have been created. He also delves into the science behind genetics, emerging technology, and what the future holds for us in terms of health and personal growth. If you've ever wondered how the universe was formed, whether God can be proven by science, how evolution really went down, and how the hell humans have come to being in the state we're in today, crazy yet still amazing, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. The 10X Your Confidence course. This is the best confidence course in the world. Why? Because I've used the tactics within this confidence course to literally change my life. I had zero confidence for many years, but after using these strategies, I've literally 10X'd my confidence and changed my life across the board. And I've used the same principles in this course to teach thousands of other guys just like you how to 10X their confidence as well. That's why you gotta go to 10xyourconfidence.com right now and check out this incredible course I've put together. For less than 10 bucks, you too can 10X your confidence in all aspects of life. Learn 10 groundbreaking strategies that will have you crushing it in dating, relationships, conversations, work, and at play. Finally become the man you know you can be, and finally get the confidence you know you were meant to have. I'm telling you right now, this course will change your life. Are you ready for it? If so, go to 10xyourconfidence.com right now and sign yourself up. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is a repeat guest from a few episodes back, Perry Marshall. Perry, thanks so much for coming back on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I'm glad you liked the first one enough to do a repeat offender.
Yeah, we've only had a few repeat offenders on the show before, man, so I had a blast at that last episode, and we talked all about the 80-20 principle and how to apply that into everyday life. And then towards the end of that episode, we mentioned your latest book, Evolution 2.0, and that really piqued my curiosity. And yeah, I just, you know, was thrilled to get you back on and have you talk about that today.
Well, it's a very deep rabbit hole. It touches a lot of things, so I'm sure we'll have no lack of interesting subjects to stumble on as we go here.
Cool. Yeah. And if all the listeners out there, if you guys haven't listened to the first episode we did, it was probably a month or so ago, I think, 4 or 5 episodes back maybe. And it really is fascinating. We talk all about butterfly effect, the 80-20 principle, not only just in marketing and sales, but again, applying that to everyday life. So make sure you check that out after this episode. Perry, let's kind of just dive right into things. Oh, man, I'm really, as I mentioned, interested in the Evolution 2.0 concept. What is this all about for those who aren't as familiar with it? Kind of how did you get on this journey of, you know, going down this rabbit hole yourself and writing a book about it?
Well, so this is about, I think, the very fabric of life itself, and it extends into business and marketing and religion and technology and science and philosophy. It really touches all of that stuff. And so it's really a huge topic. I mean, we couldn't even cover it all in one session, but I think maybe what we can do is give people a flavor of what this is about and get you to see some things in a new way and hopefully reframe some very kind of old and kind of stodgy arguments and put them in a completely new context and make them interesting again. Because I really think this is the biggest untold story in the history of science. And that's a big statement. But I think you'll see as we get through this, like, yeah, you know, there's a lot that needs to be said about this. And, you know, it started as a religious argument between myself and my brother in a bus in China in 2004. So we both grew up pastor's kids, which means that I in particular was rambunctious and mouthy and difficult to control. That's usually what that means. And so, you know, we're both Christians, and I grew up and I went into business and stuff, and he wanted to be a pastor. And so he went and got a theology degree at a very, very conservative seminary. And what he ended up doing was moving to China, teaching English, doing missionary work, and 4 years later coming home almost an atheist. Hmm. So it was like major whiplash. And he was kind of vomiting the stuff all over the place. I mean, it was kind of like he'd gotten food poisoning and he was just kind of retching all of it up. And we're pretty close. And so the emails are going back and forth and we're debating about all this stuff. And he's kind of dragging me in his direction. And I wasn't really liking it, but I'm a very rational person. And, you know, I think you have to have intellectual integrity. And so and most people that are at all serious about faith go through some version of this. But he was going through it really hot and heavy, and so was I. And so he's kind of discarding his whole entire belief system and replacing it with something else. And so I go to visit him, and we end up having yet another one of these arguments, and we're on this little trip, and we're in the back of a bus, and we're talking about this. And finally I go, Brian, look at the hand at the end of your arm. I go, now, I'm an engineer, and that is a fine piece of engineering, like really fine. Like, you don't think this is a accumulation of random accidents, do you? And he's like, hold on, buddy. And he just pushes back, and he's got this whole, and most people have kind of heard it, you know, the survival of the fittest. Like, you don't really need any designers. You just need millions of years and DNA mutations and natural selection, and it just makes everything better and better. And it doesn't work like you intuitively think it does, Perry. And the biologists know this. And I this kind of tripped an interesting circuit in my brain. And so I didn't really buy what he was saying. But I immediately knew, without arguing any further with him about it, I knew that there was an awful lot of biologists and scientists that would generally agree with him more than they would agree with me. I knew I didn't have a biology degree. I knew that there's lots of things in science that are very counterintuitive, and that I just really didn't know. And so rather than just kind of continuing to duke it out with them, I decided when I get home, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And one of the reasons for this was I'm an electrical engineer and I know science really well. Now, a lot of times when people are arguing about this stuff, you're hearing arguments between people that aren't really scientists, or they don't really understand science or whatever. And they're just kind of trading bumper sticker slogans with each other. And I said, okay, I know exactly what it is to go really deep into a subject, because I have a double E degree and I know physics and I know how to read a scientific paper. And I might not be a biologist, but I think I can start to wade into this and figure some stuff out. And so I did. I went home and I went on this binge, like buying books and I'm spending hundreds of dollars a month on books and, you know, reading them and going to websites and like really diving in. And very quickly what I found was I had to go below the surface, that there was, you know, all of these people arguing like you know, the left, the creationists versus the atheist Darwinists, and they all kind of have their, they frankly, they've all been chewing on the same bone for about 100 years. Okay. Like that argument hasn't really changed very much, and they just kind of lock into their positions and they don't really change. And they do more name calling than anything else. Okay. I had to go way down below that, and pretty soon I'm reading scientific papers, and I'm really trying to get into the hardcore science and the biology. Now, I had this question, and here's really what the question was, and it was, you know, I'm looking at the hand at the end of my arm, and, you know, in engineering you have compromises, and you have all these very finely tuned decisions. You have these very difficult and subtle decisions that you have to make about how you're going to go about designing a circuit or managing a database or designing a software program or building a car engine or whatever. And there's just all these delicate considerations. And I'm looking at a hand, I'm going, man, there's some really nicely chosen delicate considerations. And I was kind of stumped. And I said, you know, I was in engineering school for 5.5 years. And not once, like, I specialized in communication systems and control systems. Control systems would be like things like the cruise control in your car or the HVAC system in a building or a missile control system. And there's all these ways to control things and optimize things in engineering. And I said, you know, nowhere, anywhere in my engineering school did they ever tell me, well, if you make millions of copies of things and some of them have copying errors, that survival of the fittest will just automatically pick out the best ones and it'll just get better and better. That never, not once ever came up in any engineering class as a way of optimizing or designing anything. And I thought, biologists are telling us, like, this is the way the whole entire world got to be the way it is. I never even heard of it in engineering school. So did the biologists know something that we didn't know? Did we know something they didn't know? Is there something they do know that we should bring over here so that we can use it? Like, what's the deal? So I immediately saw the evolution question as an engineering problem. And this is really important and valuable, because if there's something the biologists knew, that we ought to be using it in software engineering, we ought to be using it in product development and design. This goes to marketing, and keep in mind that already at this point, when Brian and I were having this argument, I was already the author of a Google AdWords book that was selling like hotcakes. I was teaching people how to do Google campaigns and do accelerated natural selection on advertising. So, like, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to write 2 ads, not one. You're going to put them in front of these people. You're going to A/B test these things, and you're going to kill the loser as fast as you can. So we're actually doing accelerated Darwinian evolution on Google AdWords or any other, right? And so how we do this and whatever happens in biology, if there's stuff that we don't know about, this is immediately applicable not only to building products, but advertising and building businesses and all this kind of stuff. So this is not just some academic thing. This is not just some religious argument. This is not just some philosophical thing. This is not some political argument. This is really useful. This is really important. And so I flung myself into the void and I said, wherever this takes me, I'm going to follow the evidence. And, you know, if it makes me into an atheist or if it makes me change my beliefs or whatever, that's really scary. That's really uncomfortable, but I'll follow the evidence wherever it leads.
Cool. And where did it end up taking you? Did you maintain your religious beliefs, or did you become more of like a Darwinist evolutionist kind of guy, or somewhere in the middle?
Well, I did adjust quite a few of my beliefs. So let me talk about that for a second. So you got to appreciate where we grew up. We grew up in Nebraska and went to a very, very, very conservative church. And I remember like very strict. And I remember when I was 14, this guy named John Whitcomb came and he gave a whole week long seminar. Like every night there was a service at church and there's another installment. So this went on for a whole week. And so like he did probably 9 or 10 lectures in 7 days. And it was all of this science stuff. So I was loving it because I was a science geek, and it was all about how the earth is 6,000 years old. All of the geology is because of Noah's flood. The carbon dating stuff is all a big fraud. And like all this kind of stuff. And of course, and it all fits with this extremely literal interpretation of Genesis. And so, and I thought it was fantastic and everybody else thought it was fantastic. Okay. Well, now then, and it wasn't any one thing, it was just like little by little by little, you start to see the, like little chips in the veneer, like, well, actually, you know, okay, like how do you explain all of the fossils and the dinosaurs and all of that, right? And you learn about things like, well, there's not just carbon dating, there's also radioactive decay, there's also the speed of light. You know, you can see stars that are 10 million light years away, so that was all created 6,000 years ago. So does that mean that the speed of light changed? Does that mean that that God like poofed the universe into existence to look old, even though it wasn't? It like this kind of stuff, it really starts to come up, and you know, you start to wonder. Well, eventually, I bumped into this guy named Hugh Ross. He gave this talk, and he explained the Big Bang, and he explained the fine tuning of the universe, like before. Before 10 or 20 years ago, most people didn't really realize that if you have things like the mass of a proton and the charge of an electron and the strength of gravity, if all these things were on dials, and if you messed with any of the dials, even the slightest, tiniest bit, like the whole universe would just be a complete disaster. You wouldn't get stars. You wouldn't get life. You wouldn't get anything sensible. You just get a big black hole or something. And the fine tuning, like the fine tuning of the expansion of the Big Bang, if it was just a little more, it would just spray off into space and there would be no matter. If it was just a little less, it would all collapse into a black hole. And the fine tuning is 120 decimal places of precision. If it was off by 0.0000 with 100 zeros, one, if it was off by that much, it wouldn't work. Okay. Uh-huh. And he's explaining the universe is 13 billion years old and it all expanded from a single point. It all came into being. Matter, energy, time and space all came into being in a single instant. I'm listening to that and I go, wow. That is way more impressive than that Noah's Ark story. Okay. And it gives me way bigger picture of God than the Noah's Ark story. The Noah's Ark story isn't anywhere near as impressive as expansion rate of universe fine tuned to 120 decimal places. Okay. So I gave up the old version that I was given when I grew up for a much bigger view of God. You know, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. Does it still match up? Yeah, actually, it matches up just fine, except what science did was it made your picture of God much bigger, much clearer, and actually much more almost like mind-blowing, like, oh, my word, right? And like, I'm sure, Justin, you have, you know, gone to the planetariums and you have some notion how big the universe is, and that you can, you know, you can point a telescope at a sliver of a sliver of a sliver of the sky and there's still like 10 million galaxies over there, right?
Yeah.
I mean it just blows your mind. So like, now this did not take away my religion, but now I'm talking to Brian, right? And he's saying, hey, you don't. So, because I was seeing something very intentional when I looked at the hand at the end of my arm. I was like, man, this looks really intentional. And he's like, nope, it's not. it just looks intentional because of natural selection. And so I want to know, well, is this really true? Well, here's what I found. I found out two things. The first thing was, and I'll give you these in a particular order, and then we can start to unpack them. Mm-hmm. The first one was, there was this question. So would the engineers know something that the biologists don't, or vice versa? Well, the answer to that question, it took me about 2 years, and I figured out the answer to that question was neither. The biologists don't know something the engineers know, or vice versa. It's actually the cells know something that neither of us know. Huh. Okay. And so let me unpack that a little bit. So I started asking the question, so is it true if I have a cell or anything, I mean, it could be a car engine, but it's designed by an encoded program, right? So like I used to sell industrial sensors to the Ford plant in Chicago, okay? And I go in there a couple times a week, and they've got all these robots welding fenders on cars. You know, somebody's written this big program that basically builds a car, right? It's all these lines of code, and, you know, yeah, there's people working on it too, but, you know, it's like this big program, and the program builds the car. You know, a program builds a cell because DNA is digital code, and it has all these instructions in it. So can you just make millions of cells with copying errors and occasionally, like, one out of 1,000 or one out of 1,000,000 times, it's going to be better, and then natural selection just cleans up the mess and it gets better? You know what the answer is?
No.
No. The answer is no. That idea does not exist in engineering at all. Now, there are cousins to that idea, like genetic algorithms, which are evolutionary programs, and they do natural selection internally. But all of those programs are programmed, and they all operate according to very specific rules. And if you just let them run with copying errors, they just crash and burn, and they don't do anything. And what I found out was cells have exquisitely sophisticated error correction systems. Just like, and this actually goes, so let me back up a second, tell you another story. So when I was, before I was a marketing consultant, I was a sales and marketing manager at a hardware software company, and we made this really obscure networking equipment that went into factories, just like the Ford plant in Chicago, in fact. And in fact, they were one of our customers. I wrote all these magazine articles about networking stuff, and one day I get a phone call, and the guy says, "Hey, could you write an Ethernet book for the industrial guys?" And I accepted it, and so I ended up writing this Ethernet book. And so it's called Industrial Ethernet, and it's now in its third edition, the largest control society of process engineers. Well, so fast forward, and I'm trying to understand, like, this whole biology thing was extremely confusing. It was like, this is way harder than electrical engineering. Oh, my goodness. Like, cells, like, how they work and stuff. And I'm reading, I'm trying to understand about these copying errors and random mutations and stuff. And I suddenly realized, hey, wait a minute. This is digital code. Like Ethernet packets, genes, same thing, basically. It's digital information. Oh, I can understand this. I have a background in this. I can do this. And what I found, so, you know, your wireless router and your phone and your computer, they have all of these error detection circuits in them. And, you know, if somebody's running an arc welder while you're trying to watch a YouTube video, it's correcting all these errors, and it's retransmitting when the packets get dropped. And And it's amazing. Well, I found out cells have all this stuff, but it's actually better. It's better than the stuff that we make. And copying errors are fatal. They're absolutely fatal. This is why you get birth defects. Copying errors give you birth defects. They don't give you evolution. Now, if I had just stopped right there, I would have become some kind of creationist, like maybe an old earth creationist, and I would have just said, all this evolution stuff is BS. But I kept going. I kept reading books and I kept investigating because I was pretty sure I didn't really have the whole picture. And so I kept digging. And here's what I found. I found the cells reprogram themselves. A spoonful of bacteria can do more programming in 12 hours than a team of Google engineers can do in 12 months. That's the truth. And this is why you have to finish your antibiotics, because if you don't kill those suckers fast and kill them dead, they will come back with a vengeance. The antibiotics won't work, and now you have a real problem. And I'm sure we've all heard stories of relatives or friends of friends or somebody where – yeah, you know, he's in the hospital and none of the antibiotics are working and he's got a staph infection. It's raging out of control and it might kill him. I mean, you ever heard that story?
Yeah.
And so bacteria know all cells. They know they can cut, splice, rearrange their DNA. They can do stuff that we don't even know how to do. And so when you read a typical newspaper article or radio program or podcast or textbook, and somebody says that evolution is random mutations and natural selection, and it's not actually correct. That, I mean, you read that everywhere, you hear it everywhere. It is not how it works. It's not why evolution happens. It happens because cells have cognition. They have the ability to respond to their environment. They sense hundreds of signals from all temperature and humidity and predators and nutrients and all kinds of stuff. And they constantly adjust their genetics and their physiology in order to adapt. And this is why evolution is true. So when I went into this, remember, you know, I started out the young earth creationist and then like, oh, so the universe is old. So now I'm an old earth creationist. Then I find out, oh, evolution isn't a hoax. There are specific things that you can do to get a new species, sometimes even as in 24 hours. I mean, it might not even take that long if you know what to do. And all of a sudden you get something you never had before. Evolution is true too. So like, that's like two sex change operations, man. I mean, like go from this really super traditional view to, oh my goodness, evolution is true. But nevertheless, it's still like you can't explain it as some kind of random accident, because it's just not. This random accident version of how you improve things, it doesn't exist in engineering. And so what I started doing, and this goes, you know, to our 80-20 interview that we did, I started, like, in my Google advertising, Facebook advertising, I started borrowing ideas from evolutionary biology and bringing them in to the work that I do in business strategy consulting and marketing and advertising, because all of these things can be used. They're very practical. So in Evolution 2.0, my book, I say that evolution has this Swiss Army knife with five blades, and there are these five specific systems that evolutionary organisms use to change themselves, and we steal all those and we use them in advertising and marketing. In fact, right now I'm working with a software company and we're developing a product based on specifically these ideas for use in advertising. Okay. So this is actually extremely practical. It's not just some head trip and it's not like Republicans and Democrats arguing with each other. I mean, this is valuable. It's commercially valuable. It's useful to human beings.
What are those five systems you talk about?
So one of them is transposition, which is there are certain DNA elements called transposons, which control gene expression. And when you move them around, it's kind of like moving around adjectives and adverbs in a sentence, and you can change the meaning by moving them around. And organisms will, when they're faced with threats, they'll start moving those things around, and they'll change what the program in their genomes are actually saying to do. Another one is horizontal gene transfer, which is bacteria and other cells actually exchange DNA with each other. It's like, hey, I got some of this stuff. You want some? You want a program that builds a pump? Yeah, give me a program that builds a pump. They have a file sharing folder called a plasmid. I call it a Dropbox folder, but you know, they trade files with each other. There's one called symbiogenesis, which is cells merging together. So, for example, probably every kid in school learns that grass is green because it has chloroplasts, and chloroplasts turn sunlight into energy. But what they don't tell you is a chloroplast is a blue-green algae living inside a plant cell, and it is a separate, it's a separate organism. It's living, it's got its own DNA, it reproduces independently, but it lives almost like a parasite inside a plant cell. It's not really a parasite. It's a symbiont. It's a symbiotic relationship. That's a blade. Another blade is epigenetics, switching genes on and off. It's like graying out menus in a software program. You know, like when you download software and you didn't pay for it yet, and then you pay for the key, and then all of a sudden these menus go from gray to, you know, real black letters that you can click on. That's epigenetics. Another one is hybridization. You can take species one plus species two and get a new species. So, for example, emmer wheats, when blended with goat grass, gave us modern wheat. And so, like, that's a new species in 24 hours mechanism. So when you take the five of them and you put them together, you can get anywhere on the evolutionary tree of life to anywhere else. And so these are all things that you can do. You can do this in software. You can do these things in English. You can do these things with companies. Like I like to say that a chloroplast, you know, algae in a plant cell, it's like a Starbucks in a Marriott. You know, hey, there's a coffee shop in the lobby here, right? It's like they're two separate corporations, they're two separate businesses, they do separate things, but they go really well together. So, you know, that the algae inside the plant cell, that's the most successful merger acquisition in history.
Yeah, I always thought the chloroplast was part of the plant, but that's really interesting. So, Perry, where did you eventually like find yourself overall with this creationism and Darwinism, evolution? Where are you right now with it? Like, have you decided that, you know, ultimately you believe that there is a God, there is a creator of all this stuff, but the evolution has its role in this as well?
So if I was to reduce evolution 2.0 to two sentences, it would be Darwinists underestimate nature and creationists underestimate God. In other words, each from its own perspective. So, you know, a Darwinist might just be a scientist who knows that he can't say, well, God did it, that explains it, so let's go out to lunch, right? Like scientists can't do that. You know, even if a scientist is devoutly religious, he's still got a job to do. He's still got to figure out how things work, and there's still all this stuff that we don't know, right? But then, you know, then from the spiritual side, like my super conservative brethren that I grew up with and, you know, and all of that, who tend to think that evolution is like this four-letter word. And in fact, it kind of offends them when you even use the word, because they don't like it. Like, it never occurred to them that it's way more impressive Well, let's make this into a question. Which is more impressive? God beaming zebras onto the savannah from the sky, like Star Trek style, and suddenly it appears and starts eating grass? Okay. Is that more impressive, or is it more impressive to design a universe that can give birth to a cell that can blossom into an entire ecosystem with a million species and grow grass and grow a zebra, and the zebra eats the grass and the zebra craps on the grass and it's all an ecosystem? Like, which is more impressive? Well, I can tell you as an engineer, scenario number two is infinitely more impressive than just, okay, I'm going to make these species, I'm going to make these ones, I'm going to make these ones. And I actually, but what has happened is science and religion have gotten falsely pitted against each other. And they've also kind of overstepped their boundaries. There's a lot of scientists that are trying to make religious and philosophical claims that science is not able to make. There are a lot of religious people that are trying to say, well, that's impossible, science can't figure this out, et cetera, because they feel threatened by it. And I think that's inappropriate. Whereas I think if you have the right view of it, if you believe in God, then what that does is that gives you a rational reason to believe that the universe is orderly, rational, structured, logical, comprehensible, and divinely ordered. And there's a tendency that I found a very persistent tendency of atheists to underestimate the natural world, to underestimate science. So like there's this thing called the junk DNA theory. 97% of your DNA is junk and only 3% of it actually does anything. And see, look, there is no God. They've been banging that drum for 40 years. It's not true. That theory has been proven wrong. There's all this stuff in DNA. They used to think it was useless. It does all these sophisticated functions that are just amazing and very subtle and with a great deal of nuance. The atheists were telling you it was junk, and they were just saying that to further their agenda. They were actually hindering science by telling us that we shouldn't. It was just a waste of time to go study that. And of course, you can go to the other side of the aisle and you can find all kinds of religious, like the religious guy who says, oh, you know, evolution's just a hoax and that could never happen. Well, that guy's being anti-scientific too. Both sides are actually being anti-scientific and usually don't know it. And so I think you have to actually put them together. And I don't actually think that science can really press forward the way it should unless you have a sanctified view of nature, or an elevated view of where the universe comes from. It's not just this big cosmic accident. I think it's a huge disservice to science when you say, oh, you know, oh, this just happened. No, it didn't. It was very finely tuned.
Yeah, this is like all fascinating to me. So, you know, I truly appreciate it. The thing that I've always wondered, and I am kind of like with you on this, I think I'm sort of in the middle. I'm definitely, you know, a believer in God. I guess you could say I'm Christian, even though I don't go to church regularly. But I also believe in evolution as well. The thing that I always consider, though, that the big kind of like million-dollar question or whatever you want to call it is, like, what was there before God? Did God just, you know, where did he come from? Who created God? What if he did have the Big Bang and all that other stuff? What was in the universe before that happened? Was it just, you know, nothingness? And then where did he even come from? And, you know, who gave birth to him and that kind of stuff? I mean, that's just kind of being philosophical and I guess silly, because that's really not something you can prove. But it is something you think about.
Well, look, it's worth thinking about, and there's a lot to think about, and there's a lot to consider. So I'll do my best here, okay? Because I think you can chisel away at that answer. So let's just start with the universe and with physics. I mean, as far as we can tell, the universe began as a single infinitely dense point 13.8 billion years ago and exploded into existence, and the expansion of the universe and space causes the forward motion of time. And so as far as you can tell, matter, energy, space, and time came into being at a specific instant. Okay. And when you go, well, what was before the Big Bang? Well, in the human sense of the word before, that's not even a valid concept because there was no time. But if you believe in cause and effect, or if you believe in logic, then you believe that something had to have caused this to happen. So the something is necessarily transcendent, or at least much bigger and beyond. It's beyond the dimensions. Like, you almost kind of have to think of the universe as being like a book that starts on page one and goes to page 312. And in the book has a starting and an end point, but a character inside the books goes, okay, so where's the guy that wrote this? And it's like, well, he's outside the book. Okay. You kind of have to step outside of it. In engineering school, I took a class called matrix theory, which actually was very helpful in me conceptualizing this thing, where in matrix theory, a dimension, like, you know, north and south is a dimension, east and west is a dimension, up and down is a dimension, time is a dimension. So there's four dimensions. In matrix theory, you just throw those in a matrix and, oh, you want four dimensions? You want five? You want six? That's what string theory is. String theory is like, well, we think there's 11 or 12 dimensions of the universe. Here's what we think they are. One of them's time. You know, there's space, et cetera. And that you can start to think, yeah, there's dimensions outside of. And in mathematics, you can do that very easily, and you can actually come up with all of these theorems around it. Wait. And this is one of the beauties of mathematics, is it gives you the ability to step outside of the normal bounds. Now what Judeo-Christian theology has thought about this stuff really hard for a long time, and you can go back to people like Thomas Aquinas, for example, which is about 1200 AD, if I'm not mistaken, and they're considering these questions, and they're saying, well, so God is outside of space, outside of time, infinite, boundless, and, you know, capable of creating any dimension that he wants to. What C.S. Lewis said was that, you know, that the earth is like a book, you know, that God wrote. And you could have a book where the author is not found anywhere inside the book at all. Right?
Yeah.
The book doesn't even mention the author. But the way C.S. Lewis put it was, God wrote himself into the human story through Jesus. And what I've found in my investigation is that the Christian conception of God is actually very logical. Now, if you want an author to go read that'll really get you thinking about, so I would recommend Pascal, who lived in about 1600. He wrote a book called The Penzies, which were like Pascal's questions about the big, big stuff. And it goes, so he was a mathematician, and he asked questions about, you know, space and time, but he also asked questions about humans and morality and all of that. And, you know, I think these are really important questions. And if they itch at you, and if they bug you, you should go after them. And you need to know that incredibly smart people have been working on this stuff for a long time, and they've come up with really good perspectives. I don't want to call them definitive answers, but they really do make a lot of sense. And a lot of these ideas, they were worked out in the Middle Ages, and then we were able to give birth to science. So science was birthed out of a theological belief that God made a universe that was rational, orderly, understandable, that time had a forward arrow that there was a positive upward progress to the universe and that we could figure it out. And that's what the medieval Christian theologians believed, and that's why we ended up with a Copernicus and a Galileo and a Newton. And I'll just point out, almost none of those early guys were atheists. And it's not because they were burning atheists at the stake or something like that. There's always been atheists around, but you had to have a philosophical framework for even having the idea of science in the first place, because the world is so complex and there's so many things going on. We take all these things for granted. Like when it thunders, nobody today thinks, oh, you know, God's just moving furniture upstairs. You know, we know that there's a way, there's lightning and sound waves. Like, we understand all that. They didn't understand all that. But how did they ever even get the idea of parsing that and breaking it up and like that Newton could reduce all astronomy to a gravitational law that you can write on a 3x5 card? Like, people before that would have never conceived that such a thing was possible. But I think it was the theological and philosophical framework that said, oh, we should be looking for something like that. And he looked for it and he found it. And now we take it for granted.
Yeah. No, this is all incredibly fascinating stuff, man. I'm going to totally check out that book. Is there a couple other guys you recommend checking out as far as this type of work, that, you know, maybe books in the past that you've read, or, you know, famous authors like Pascal to check out?
Well, I've mentioned C.S. Lewis. He's really good. Now, he's not really so much of a science guy. Let's see. I'll give you a couple. Let's jump to the current century. You know, my book Evolution 2.0 kind of describes this whole evolution perspective of telling you what's really going on inside the cell. There's another book that's very readable and very accessible by a good friend of mine named Dennis Noble, and it's called Dance to the Tune of Life, Biological Relativity. And I'll just give you, like, I'll try to give you a thumbnail sketch of what his book is about. He's an Oxford professor. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He has a Commander of the British Empire designation from the Queen of England. And he's the guy who figured out the cardiac rhythm, which made pacemakers possible. Very distinguished scientist. He's 80 years old. And he's been on a crusade for the last few years to reform the evolution business, because he thinks the whole thing is incredibly screwed up, which it is. He organized a conference a year ago in London at the Royal Society. In his book, he explains that in the same way that we thought the Earth was the center of the universe, and we thought the sun was the center of the universe, and then we got big enough telescopes and we realized it's almost like there isn't a center of the universe, because space is curved and it's really trippy. You know, it's almost like wherever you are is the center of the universe almost. Well, he said biology is actually the same way, that for the last 50 years or 100, we've thought that genes were the center of biology, and they're not. Genes are just a relative player within a biological system, along with other systems, the same way that the Earth or the Sun is a relative player in a galaxy, in a cosmos, and that there's no central starting point of biology, that it's all interdependent systems within systems within systems, and that until you change your point of view, it's kind of like standing on the Earth and you know, thinking there's a big dome with stars painted on or something, and not really realizing the subtlety of what's going on, and that this has caused huge mistakes in biology that we are continuing to pay the price for. And again, this is a guy who, it was because of his heart research that he realized that the traditional evolutionary model was completely wrong, because he started doing things to the genes that they told him to do, and they work completely different than the theory predicted. And he said, therefore, the theory is wrong. Therefore, we need a new theory. And again, this sounds like really esoteric, but it's a very readable book. And I think any high school, at least a determined high school kid, could read it. So if you look up biological relativity on Amazon, you'll quickly find it. I think that's a wonderful book.
Okay, cool. And the other one was Dance to the Tune of Life.
It's the same book. And so there's a whole revolution going on in biology right now. It's been fashionable for years to say, well, you know, living things are purposeless and it's just molecules and it's just atoms. But actually, there is so much going on. Like, and I we've only got a couple minutes here, but I got to mention my prize because, so remember, I discovered that, well, DNA is actually digital code. Well, yeah. Where does code come from? How do you get code without designing one? You know, there's a million codes and 999,999 are designed. And then there's this one code and we don't know where it came from. It's called DNA and there aren't any codes that aren't designed. And I've been on the internet for about 12 years arguing this point, and for about a good 5 years, I was just using this as, hey, man, I've got proof that God exists right here. It's called code. And I kind of adjusted my approach. And this is like, you know, yet another sex change operation, if you will. It's kind of like the other two, where I eventually said, you know what? You know, maybe the code is a divine miracle, and I'm fine if it is. But what if it's not? And what if we can figure it out? What would the implications of that be? And so I went and I organized a group of investors and we formed a corporation called Natural Code LLC. And we put together a $5 million technology prize. And I announced it at Arizona State University on August 28. I have judges from Harvard, Oxford, and MIT on my judging panel. And we are looking for a naturally occurring code. Can you get digital code without designing digital code? Is there a way to get it from chemicals? Now, as far as we know now, there's no way, but maybe there's a way. And if there is, we want to buy the patents and we want to own the rights to it. And we want to reward the person for discovering it and partner them in as a shareholder in our company. So it's called the Evolution 2.0 Prize. It's if you go to naturalcode.org, you can read about it. It's on the HeroX platform alongside prizes by IBM and Coca-Cola and a bunch of other companies. And, like, this is one of the biggest mysteries in science, and we want to crack it. Yeah. So that's kind of my story in, you know, 50 minutes or so.
Awesome, man. Really quickly, before we kind of wrap things up, can you just talk about the Human Genome Project? I keep hearing this, not too familiar with it, but I know you are, and I just wanted to ask you about that before we wrap things up.
Well, yeah, there's two things I want to say about it. So the Human Genome Project, back in about 2001, they finally got the whole thing sequenced, and finally they knew, you know, every single base pair in a strand of DNA, which has about 3 billion letters. And so the Human Genome Project has been all about trying to figure out how all of the code in our DNA directly maps to what color eyes you have and what diseases you get and how tall you are and like every possible thing like that. And that has proven to be a much more difficult project than thought. Like, people thought this was going to be a fairly straightforward thing, and it turns out it's like unraveling this foreign language that's just hideously complex. And so, you know, so now you can go get your 23andMe thing and, you know, and it'll give you a report, but it's very, very approximate. Now, the other... So that's kind of what it is. Now there's something new that's going on that I think people need to be aware of, which is we can now edit genomes. almost as easy as find and replace in Microsoft Word. There's a technology called CRISPR that allows you to do that, and it's all the rage, and the biotech companies are investing in it and all of that. Well, you know that is kind of scary, right?
Yeah, I actually just heard that a couple, like 2 days ago, that they got guys from Harvard and California doing that right now, changing like one letter in your, they know how to like swap letters or whatever in the code, and it can completely, like, this is like the first step to completely changing your genes from this point forward.
Right, and one of those guys is on my judging panel.
Oh,
his name is George Church. He's from Harvard and MIT, and he's a genome rock star. And like, so there's people working on this, but I have a caution, and here's the caution. Okay. So there's a book. It's called A Crack in Creation by Jennifer Doudna. And she's one of the pioneers, and this is a really hot book right now. And it's all about all the stuff that you can do and the pros and the cons and all that. Page 4 of the book, it says, we know that evolution happens through random mutation and natural selection, and now for the first time, we're going to take control of the evolutionary process, and it's going to be directed, you know, instead of just being haphazard. I mean, kind of sort of what she says. Mm-hmm. Part of that's wrong. It's not random. The mutations aren't random. The cellular changes are not random. It's unbelievably sophisticated. And if you go into this thing thinking that you're smarter than the cells are, you're going to make a big mistake. Hmm. And the world has been running on a theory of evolution now for about 70 years. That's wrong. And I document all this in my book very carefully, Evolution 2.0. The current theory of evolution that most people hear is wrong. And if you do genome editing based on that theory, you're going to kill a whole bunch of people. And you don't even have to be modifying the humans. You could be modifying mosquitoes. You could be modifying bacteria or viruses or what have you. We have to be very careful because we don't know as much as we think we do. We are a 14-year-old kid with his dad's screwdriver messing around in a Ferrari engine. And there might be some things we know how to fix. And that may be true. But we don't know as much as we think we do. And you can't test this stuff the way you test computer software. It's not the same. And if the thing gets out, like we've all seen the science fiction movies where the thing gets out. And so, man, you got to be really careful. And really, we have to massively update our model of evolution before anybody has any business going very far with this. And this is why, again, this is not just some philosophical abstract thing. This is one of the reasons I wrote this book. Like, people need to know this, and ordinary people need to know this because this affects you. Like, this is coming to, you know, a biology lab near you. This is going to affect your life.
Yeah. No, I love it, man. We do got to wrap it up. Perry, it's been awesome having you back on, man. Maybe we can get you on in the future. And, you know, I could keep talking for hours, man, but we do got to wrap it up. This is so interesting. I appreciate your time. Really quickly, what is the website you want to send our listeners to check out more about your work and also remind them of the book?
You can get 3 free chapters of the book and information about the prize at cosmicfingerprints.com. You can buy Evolution 2.0 on Audible, on Amazon, Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and it'll change the way you see the hand at the end of your arm.
Awesome. Thanks again, Perry, for coming on, brother. Really do appreciate it. Take care, and I will talk to you soon.
Justin, thank you for asking some really, you know, risky questions and getting philosophical. I like it when people do that. Thank you.
Anytime, man. I appreciate it and enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed learning and, you know, picking your brain again.
Hey, well, thanks for having me on your show. It really is an honor. And yeah, you know, we can come back sometime and, you know, tackle another thing if you like. So thanks for doing this.
As always, if you haven't joined the Elite Man Mastermind group on Facebook yet, do yourself a big favor and get on that right now. Connect with thousands of guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves every single day. This is the best Facebook group on the planet, totally free, and this is going to push you, motivate you, inspire you, give you tips, advice, and strategies for helping you master the biggest challenges in your life. EliteManMastermind.com will take you right to the group on Facebook where you can join. It's a closed group, which means it might take a couple minutes, a couple hours for you to get accepted in by one of the moderators or myself, but I promise you we will get you in if you're not a spammer and you don't have a creepy profile. So go to EliteManMastermind.com if you haven't yet. Join the group. You're going to absolutely love this and join a collection of thousands of amazing guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves and help you out along the way.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.